This allows Kamara to prioritize the work using objective criteria. Before Scrum, he says, people were asking for everything at once, and with the limited resources of a nonprofit, they couldn't do everything, so the effect was doing nothing. Now, in each sprint, the different groups who want features come in and pitch what they want done, and in a transparent way, they see exactly how their feature stacks up against others. That helps a group with precious little to leverage determine what will have the greatest impact. As I've seen elsewhere, this kind of work quickly spreads to the rest of the Kinshasa office, changing the way they do their 9-to-5 jobs. The office used to have the sort of weekly meeting that everyone dreads, an hours-long status update during which problems were stated and complained about, but little was done. The meeting lasted forever, and everyone left unsatisfied. Often the only result was laying blame rather than seeking solutions. Now, Kamara says, every team has a Scrum board. Before the meeting, problems and blockages become easily apparent. These days, the director of the office can simply walk around and instantly see where things are being blocked or stymied just from checking out the state of the Scrum board. If you talk to people in the world of non-governmental organizations, a common complaint is that their ranks are filled with people who share purpose and commitment but lack discipline. What Scrum can do is take people's passion and, by giving them clarity regarding what they should prioritize, harness it. It's easy to make the business case for Scrum. If you use it, you'll make more money, a lot more. You'll get twice as much done in half the time. But the brightest promise for humanity lies with those people who have devoted their lives to helping the poorest of the poor. If Scrum can help these individuals who've been working on the margins to get the same effect, a giant step will have been made toward achieving a broad social good. Not only will that good arrive sooner, it will also be measurable. Scrum gives people the ability to measure progress easily. At the Grameen Foundation, they have what they call the Progress Out of Poverty Index. It measures just how effective each program is. They can poll and see exactly the impact those community knowledge workers with cell phones in rural villages are having. They can experiment with different ways of doing things. They can help people innovate their way out of poverty. For me, it's amazing to see Scrum returning to its roots. When I first started Scrum, I was inspired by the Grameen Bank and other microfinance institutions and how they help teams of poor people work together to leverage themselves out of poverty. They'd get together a team of them and have each person come up with a business plan, laying out what they'd do with $25. One might want to buy a cart to sell fruit in the town square. Another might want to buy a sewing machine to make dresses she could sell. Only when all the loans on the team were paid back would the group be lent any more money. They'd meet each week to see how they could help one another. The results were amazing. Initially, the woman with the sewing machine might make enough money to feed her children. A few weeks later, she might be able to afford shoes for them. Then she could send them to school. A few cycles later, she'd have a small business and could start building a real house. At the time, I told the software programmers I was working with, "These poor people have no shoes, and yet they can leverage their way out of poverty. You have shoes, but no software." They figured a way to work together to get out of misery. Are you willing to do the same? And so Scrum was born. Nonprofits are just one area where we can innovate social good. What about how we organize ourselves? What about government? Government. Government is not only how we organize the public sphere, how we get roads and police and courts and the DMV. It's also how we formalize who we are as a people. It is a codification of who we believe we are. In the United States, the fundamental aspirations of the American people are captured in a document signed by a bunch of rebels who surely would have hanged separately if they didn't hang together. The Declaration of Independence. Penned by an aristocratic, idealistic, slaveholding landowner, the Declaration, surprisingly, captured a radical concept of what kind of people Revolutionary-era Americans wanted to be. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. It's hard to appreciate in the modern day what a departure from the norm those words represented. While the ideas of the Enlightenment had begun to spread, there were no democracies at the time. Rule was imposed from above, from the divine right of kings and the power of arms. Great empires ruled much of the world, not only Great Britain, but also France, Austria, Russia, and Ottoman. The idea that individuals were endowed with rights, rather than granted them by the powerful, was, to put it mildly, revolutionary. The Republic was a form of government that emerged from those ideals. Like Rodney Brooks' robot learning to walk, the United States lurched to its feet, stumbled, fell, and occasionally wandered down the wrong path. But those ideals inspired revolutions the world over, and today, most major powers are governed, at least in form, by the people they purport to represent. The problem, of course, is 200-plus years of bureaucratic buildup, permanent interests embedded in the very structure of the government that make it hard for people's voices to be heard. Corruption, whether on the small scale of bureaucrats taking bribes for their services, or on the grand scale of large banks garnering wealth by privatizing profit and socializing loss, is a result of a lack of transparency and the centralization of power in the hands of the few. In most world capitals, there's grown up a courtier class that constitutes the permanent government. Contracts are awarded, money is made, and power is conferred by whom you know, not by what you bring. Nowhere is this more evident than in the way politicians, generals, and powerful bureaucrats rotate from government to industry and back again. The number of 4-star generals heading up defense contractors, or senators becoming lobbyists, or former administration officials heading up trade groups is staggering. But as I emphasized in Chapter 3, it's pointless to look for evil people. Look instead for evil systems. Let's ask a question that has a chance to actually change things. What is the set of incentives that drives bad behavior? I truly doubt that any of the Beltway bandits sees themselves as bad people, and I bet that most are truly well-meaning. It's the system that has failed them, and us. But how do we change it? How do we encourage transparency, priorities, and accountability? You know the answer. Scrum. Let's start a few thousand miles west of Washington, D.C., in the Washington state capital, Olympia. There, the past two administrations, first a Republican, now a Democrat, have embraced what they call lean government. The current governor, Jay Inslee, said in a campaign interview in the fall of 2012, "A lot of what the state does is make decisions. We want to find a way to leave less paper on a desk." The governor's plan has 5 points that could have been plucked from any campaign platform. 1. A world-class education system from preschool through college. 2. A prosperous economy. 3. Making Washington a national leader in sustainable energy and a clean environment. 4. Healthy and safe communities. 5. Efficient, effective, and accountable government. These are not revolutionary goals. This is what people should expect from their government. The very fact they sound clichéd is an indicator of their importance. A cliché, after all, is just a truth repeated enough times to become trite. But what's different about Inslee's administration is how they're going about it. They've dubbed their new approach SMART. Specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. In other words, they want to use Scrum. And, in fact, they are. The Office of the Chief Information Officer of the State of Washington is responsible not only for what technology is purchased, but how it's made. The CIO's office is made up of 20 people who are supposed to make sure massive IT failures costing tens of millions of dollars don't happen. Meanwhile, the department handles IT upgrades for the parts of the government that do everything from issue driver's licenses to distribute unemployment benefits to regulate fish and wildlife. In 2012, they oversaw 80 requests, totaling more than $400 million. And they issue standards and guidance to various agencies on how to implement state policy. To do that, they use Scrum. They've actually torn down the cubicle walls in their offices and formed into Scrum teams. Michael D'Angelo, the deputy CIO, says they try to deliver actionable, implementable policies to state departments every week. We're updating our process for how our agencies submit plans for investment. We set the goal that every week we're going to change one thing. We're taking an incremental approach. We have a potentially shippable product every single week that can be felt by the agencies. They actually have something tangible. Shippable product, in their case, means actionable changes to policy. It doesn't have to be a thing, it just has to be something, anything, that creates value. Instead of trying to create a grand, overriding document anticipating every piece of the funding process, they've decided to do it piece by piece. They want to deliver improvements in how the state is run every single week. Reaction, says D'Angelo, has been mixed. There's a huge fear of not having a perfect product. Speaking in August of 2013, he said, "Just last week we made a change to how customers call us. But there's a lot of documentation where we still have the old way listed, on our website, documents, that kind of thing. So there was all this other stuff we would have to change first. We decided not to wait, to just do it. We'll update documentation in the next sprint. The alternative is that we don't give them a better way for months. We're robbing them of value." The other thing the CIO's office is doing is trying to push Scrum through the entire state bureaucracy. It's why they've changed their own processes to Scrum, to become an example, to be able to speak from experience. The benefits are just too great not to. But there are some roadblocks. D'Angelo says that one thing they've realized is that in some cases, the waterfall method is actually written into state law. Changing that can be tough. The state of Washington funds things in 2-year cycles. You have to ask for big chunks. You can't say we'll add value until you tell us to stop, says D'Angelo. The government wants to see that it's going to cost this amount of money and that we'll get this amount of value in this time frame. That's so they can talk about it with citizens, even though we know it's much more inefficient. Part of the problem is that in the United States, both at the federal and state level, legislatures are broken into committees. One group of lawmakers looks at education, another at crime, another at the budget, and yet another at social services. They are fractured. They never look at the whole picture, says Rick Anderson. He's a consultant to state agencies, counties, and cities in Washington, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. He has worked with the legislatures, and he says that while change may take a while, it has to happen. He thinks they should start setting performance-based goals. Okay, Agency X, here are your goals. Here are your expected outcomes. Once you have that, you can start writing legislation that is outcome-based, he says. In a revamped, Scrum-driven world, instead of approving a specific plan to build a bridge across a river, a legislative body would say to the highway department, "We want X number of people to be able to travel over this waterway in Y amount of time with Z cost. How you do that is up to you." That would allow for discovery and innovation. Instead, the norm these days is construction projects that run hundreds of millions of dollars over budget. The reason? As crews work on the project, they discover new problems and new ways of solving them. Instead of stifling that kind of innovation with change control boards and massive reporting, we should be encouraging it. But what about those ideals I started this section with, where a society shapes itself through a document, a constitution, say? Well, one country decided that the way to develop a constitution that truly represented the will of the people was to use Scrum. In 2008, a completely avoidable financial crisis hit the world. Big banks spun prices out of control, leveraging themselves over and over again by taking on more bad debt than could ever be repaid. One of the countries hit hardest was Iceland. Privatized banks there had been spun off by the government and had taken huge risks in the financial markets. As they say on Wall Street, if you don't know who the sucker in the room is, you're the sucker. In this case, Iceland was the sucker. The amount of money they borrowed was staggering for such a small country. Eventually, the banks had valuations 12 times the size of the national budget. When it all came crashing down, the Icelandic economic miracle was in tatters. In an expression of outrage, the citizens of Reykjavik took to the streets and banged pots and pans together outside the Althing, their parliament. The government that had overseen the financial practices collapsed in what became known as the Pots and Pans Revolution. The government stepped down and new leadership promised a new constitution. To write that constitution, some officials decided to be open and engage with people. So they formed a constitutional committee which decided to use Scrum. Each week, the committee would meet, decide on one section of the document, and deliver it to the public every Thursday. Then they'd collect feedback from the people through Facebook and Twitter. In just a few months, they had a new document that had won the overwhelming support of the Icelandic public. It was a new expression of how they saw themselves. Unfortunately, the powers that had benefited from the financial fraud struck back. After filing delay after delay, after obfuscating, complaining, and acting against the will of the people, a new parliament, made up of the same parties that oversaw the destruction of Iceland's economy, decided to simply ignore the new constitution. A key demand of the revolution was denied. For now, anyway. The world is changing, and those who profit from secrecy and deception will soon find they have few places left to hide. Scrum is changing the world around them, and while they may fight a rearguard action, change is inevitable. The Scrum framework is just so much faster, transparent, and responsive to the wishes of the people that it will ultimately defeat the politicians who stand in its way. Change or die. How will all work one day? Earlier in this book, I discussed the martial arts concept of shu ha ri. People in the shu state follow the rules exactly, so they learn the ideas behind them. People in the ha state begin to create their own style within the rules, adapting them to their needs. People in the ri state exist beyond the rules. They embody the ideals. Watching a true master in the ri state is like looking at a moving work of art. His or her actions seem impossible, but that's because the master has become a philosophy in flesh, an idea made real. All of this, which is to preface the fact that there are some rules in Scrum, and you would do well to both learn and transcend them. I've included them as an appendix to this book, Implementing Scrum, How to Begin. And I've written chapter after chapter on why those rules exist, encouraging you, I hope, to apply them in your personal life, your company, and your community. The paradox of those rules, though, is that they eliminate boundaries. They create freedom. And for many, freedom can be terrifying. One company that has learned how to set its employees free and optimize innovation is Valve. To look at the firm is to behold how we all may inevitably organize ourselves, whether it's to make better software, raise people out of poverty, plan a wedding, or fix up a house. Formed in the 1990s as a video game company making revolutionary hits such as Half-Life and Portal, Valve is completely self-funded and owns all its own intellectual property. Almost all of its 300-plus employees are located in a single office tower in Bellevue, Washington. The company has over 50 million customers, and it makes hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And no one is really in charge. Valve's origin is, of all places, Microsoft. Nowadays, Microsoft is a very different company. But back in the 1990s, it was the epitome of the top-down corporation. Everyone defined themselves by how far down the corporate pyramid they were from founder and CEO Bill Gates, back then the richest man in the world, and still one of the richest. Greg Coomer is among the group of people who founded Valve. He worked for Gabe Newell, who headed a development group at Microsoft. Greg describes how that hyper-attentiveness to stature played out in the very tools people used. At Microsoft, there was an Outlook plugin called Org Chart, and any email anyone would get, they'd click on that and see where the sender fit in the company. How many clicks away from Bill they were, how many direct reports they had, were they an enemy or a friend, all this could be discovered just from their position in the org chart. Greg says that if you zoomed out, you could see that there was this giant pyramid with Bill at the top. If you zoomed in, there are bunches of smaller pyramids. It was pyramids all the way down. Except for Gabe Newell's group. There were a few hundred people in it, and they all reported directly to him. It stuck out visually in the org chart app, says Greg. It was something that didn't fit, and it was causing political problems because he didn't have the right number of managers or the right structure. The company's response was almost like that of white blood cells massing to attack an infection. Now, of course, Microsoft already has 3,000 people working on Scrum teams and is moving towards some 20,000 people. But back then, this infection had to be removed. So Gabe, Greg, and a few others left and formed their own company, Valve. A few years ago, Greg tried to compose an employee handbook explaining how Valve works. The document didn't list pay grades or whether glasses were covered by the flex spending account. Rather, it was an attempt to convey the Valve ethos. I figured out it was taking 9 to 16 months for people to internalize the Valve way of doing things. It took a long time for people to feel empowered, says Greg. The document was intended to ease people in quicker, but Greg and the other founders struggled with the words because they didn't want it to seem that the explanation was coming from on high. The first section is Welcome to Flatland. It's our shorthand way of saying that we don't have any management and nobody reports to anybody else. We do have a founder president, but even he isn't your manager. This company is yours to steer toward opportunities and away from risks. You have the power to greenlight projects. You have the power to ship products. A flat structure removes every organizational barrier between your work and the customer enjoying that work. Every company will tell you that the customer is boss, but here that statement has weight. There's no red tape stopping you from figuring out for yourself what our customers want and then giving it to them. If you're thinking to yourself, wow, that sounds like a lot of responsibility, you're right. Here's how a project starts at Valve. Someone decides to start it. That's it. They figure out what they think is the best use of their time and energy, what will serve the company and the customer the best, and they do it. How do they get other people to work with them on it? They convince them. If that other person thinks it's a good idea, they'll join that team, or cabal, as it's called at Valve. All the hundreds of desks at Valve have wheels. As people start to work together on a project, they literally vote with their desks, moving them into a new configuration. Greg describes the way it worked for a product called Big Picture. One of Valve's biggest products is their Steam platform. It delivers video games and software to users. Both Valve games and third-party games are on the platform. It's the dominant way PC games are delivered today. But as Greg recalls, at one point, he and a couple of others feared they were already reaching as many customers as they could, more than 50 million. We started thinking about how our company was growing and how Steam is growing, and we were looking at what we thought would be the limit on the number of customers we could reach. We wanted to reach people in other places, in their living room, on mobile devices, whatever. So he started talking to people, some designers, some other folks. He convinced them it was a good idea to come up with something that would work on televisions, phones, and tablets, and they created the idea of Big Picture, a way to deliver video games to those platforms. But the people Greg had convinced didn't have all the skills needed to actually make it. They knew what they wanted it to look like, but they didn't have the ability to implement it. So we started mocking up what it could look like, and then we made a movie of how cool it would be, and we used that movie to recruit people to the project. We couldn't code it, so we needed to recruit people who could. So they did. It shipped about a year later. Who decided when to ship it? The people who worked on it. Who decided it was good enough? The people who worked on it. When a company has optimized itself around innovation, they usually change in a fundamental way by eliminating internal structures and hierarchies, any internal structure, says Greg. Valve operates that way all the time. They don't wait to be forced into change by a crisis. They are constantly changing. It's the day-to-day way they run the company. From the Valve Handbook. Valve is not averse to all organizational structure. It crops up in many forms all the time, temporarily. But problems show up when hierarchy or codified divisions of labor either haven't been created by the group's members or when those structures persist for long periods of time. We believe those structures inevitably begin to serve their own needs rather than those of Valve's customers. The hierarchy will begin to reinforce its own structure by hiring people who fit its shape, adding people to fill subordinate support roles. Its members are also incented to engage in rent-seeking behaviors that take advantage of the power structure rather than focusing on simply delivering value to customers. It may seem that Valve would be vulnerable to freeloaders, to people who want to take advantage of the system, but peer review is constant. Sure, people get to decide what to work on, but if they can't convince anyone else it's a good idea, maybe it really isn't. Greg says that instead of having the luxury of having someone tell you what to do, you have a group of peers telling you what they think of what you've decided to do. It isn't a perfect system. No human organization is. But usually at Valve, personnel concerns are raised first by fellow team members talking with one another. They may bring in others to consult. It may result in feedback, a harsh corrective move, or even dismissal, but it's a team decision. The exception occurred in 2013, when Valve developed a problem their system wasn't quite able to handle. For the first time ever, they hired a large group of people all at once. They decided to branch into hardware and mobile, and they simply didn't have the skills to do it. So they hired a bunch of people to tackle the problem. But hiring that many people simultaneously who weren't acclimated to the Valve way of doing things caused problems. There were pockets of workers not making decisions in the traditional Valve way. They were telling other people what to do. And, most damning, not performing up to the high Valve standards. Normally, other team members wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior, but because everyone in the group was new, their peers didn't have enough confidence in the Valve way to take action. So a group of the core Valve people who have been around for a while took action to protect the Valve ethos, even though they had to act outside of the ethos to do it, says Greg. The company fired a few dozen people at once. Talking to Greg, you can tell he sees that as a failure. He describes it as an almost biological reaction, one that was oddly parallel to how Microsoft acted toward Valve's founders. Organisms attacking foreign invaders to protect the whole. We've been talking a lot about what it means to our stated goals that we had to act outside them, reflects Greg, and how we can avoid it in the future, and not have to rely on a group of people who have been at the company a long time. He stops for a moment and then says with confidence, "By this time next year, we'll have figured it out." There's a faith in what they've done. They've consistently sought to maximize human freedom, ability, and creativity. While there have been occasional hiccups, it's just too powerful a way of operating not to be replicated over and over again. This is a capitalist innovation as powerful as many industrial innovations that change the nature of work, he says. It is so useful and so successful that there's no way it can't be a force of change in the world. Do they use Scrum? Well, says Greg, you walk down the hallway and you see a lot of whiteboards on wheels covered with sticky notes. But they don't force people to use it. They let people decide what process is right for them. As with most matters, Greg and the other founders refrain from telling anyone what to do. But a lot of Valve's workers have decided that, given the choice to do anything, they choose Scrum. And that's enough for me. You don't see many companies like Valve yet, but more are appearing each day. And not only in software. Morningstar, the global leader in tomato processing, has no bosses. Each employee negotiates with other employees as to roles and responsibilities, whether they involve sales, driving trucks, or doing sophisticated engineering. With any company, first you have to get employees to set themselves free, and then you have to get them to accept the responsibility that comes with that. Or, as Funkadelic put it back in 1970, free your mind and your ass will follow. What can't we do? Cynicism is perhaps a rational response to despair, but it is one of the most corrosive of human states. The early years of this century have been rife with the elements that breed cynicism. Senseless wars draped in patriotism, nihilistic terrorism masquerading as faith, greed cloaked in ideological righteousness, ambitious political courtiers pursuing their own selfish ends. The cynic will sigh knowingly and say, "That's just the way the world works. Humans are essentially corrupt and selfish. Pretending otherwise is just naive." And that way, they justify constraints and rationalize limits. Over the past two decades, I've delved deeply into the literature of what makes greatness. The surprising answer is that fundamentally, humans want to be great. People want to do something purposeful to make the world, even if just in a small way, a better place. The key is getting rid of what stands in their way, removing the impediments to their becoming who they're capable of becoming. That's what Scrum does. It sets goals and systematically, step by step, works out how to get there. And even more important, it identifies what is stopping us from getting there. Scrum is the code of the anti-cynic. Scrum is not wishing for a better world or surrendering to the one that exists. Rather, it is a practical, actionable way to implement change. I know of Scrum projects aimed at delivering vaccines to endangered children, and of others intended to build houses more cheaply, eliminate petty corruption, catch violent criminals, eliminate hunger, and send people to other planets. None of the above are dreamy desires. Rather, they're actionable plans. Make no mistake, these plans will have to be inspected, adapted, and changed every step of the way, but they're in motion. All around the world, rapid iterations are occurring, propelling us toward a better world. That's what I hope you'll take away from this book. The knowledge that it is possible, that you can change things, that you don't have to accept the way things are. All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible. T.E. Lawrence, from The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Don't listen to cynics who tell you what can't be done. Amaze them with what can. The takeaway. Scrum accelerates all human endeavors. The type of project or problem doesn't matter. Scrum can be used in any endeavor to improve performance and results. Scrum for schools. In the Netherlands, a growing number of teachers are using Scrum to teach high school. They see an almost immediate improvement in test scores of more than 10%, and they're engaging all sorts of students, from vocational to gifted. Scrum for poverty. In Uganda, the Grameen Foundation is using Scrum to deliver agricultural and market data to poor rural farmers. The result? Double the yield and double the revenue for some of the poorest people on the planet. Rip up your business cards. Get rid of all titles, all managers, all structures. Give people the freedom to do what they think best and the responsibility to be accountable for it. You'll be surprised at the results. Acknowledgements. Any project isn't the result of one person's work. It is the product of a team, and this book is no exception. First, I'd like to thank my son, J.J. Sutherland. He suggested we write a book together on the truly remarkable journey Scrum has taken me on a few years ago. He wanted a break from a decade of running from one war and disaster to another for NPR, and he thought the story of how Scrum came to be, why it works, and how it has changed the world not only was an important one to tell, but would also be a lot of fun. The book you're listening to, While My Story, is the product of many hours together, but he is the one who put the words on the page. Howard Yoon, the savviest of literary agents, asked us to think bigger and broader and farther. His insight, advice, wisdom, and just plain canny know-how not only made this book happen, but took it to a vastly different scale. It's not often you get the chance to work with a true master of his craft, and I've been incredibly lucky to have the chance with Rick Horgan at the Crown Publishing Group. His deft and thorough touch just makes stuff better, and he makes it look so easy. Hats off and true thanks. Chief Product Owner Alex Brown, Joe Justice, and the rest of the team at Scrum Inc. shared critical ideas, boundless energy, and deep experience. I'd also like to thank Professors Hirotaka Takeuchi and Ikujiro Nonaka, whose work sparked the idea of Scrum and who have since become good friends. My fellow co-creator, Ken Schwaber, whose irascible doggedness helped shape Scrum and make it the force that it is today. Most of all, my wife, Arlene. She was there from the beginning, and as a Unitarian Universalist minister, introduced Scrum to many churches. She made the world a better place when she showed us how to Scrum an entire organization. And finally, I'd like to thank the hundreds of thousands of Scrum masters and product owners and teams across the planet who actually live Scrum every day. You make Scrum the vibrant and positive force that it is in the world, and you never cease to astound me with what you have accomplished with it. Appendix. Implementing Scrum, how to begin. Now that you've listened to the book, here's how to start a Scrum project in a nutshell. This is a very broad stroke description of the process, but it should be enough to get you started. The book was written to give you the why behind Scrum. This will, in abbreviated form, give you the how. 1. Pick a product owner. This person is the one with a vision of what you're going to do, make, or accomplish. They take into account risks and rewards, what is possible, what can be done, and what they are passionate about. Listen to Chapter 8, Priorities, for more. 2. Pick a team. Who will be the people actually doing the work? This team needs to have all the skills needed to take the product owner's vision and make it a reality. Team should be small. 3 to 9 people is the rule of thumb. Listen to Chapter 3, Teams, for more. 3. Pick a Scrum Master. This is the person who will coach the rest of the team through the Scrum framework and help the team eliminate anything that is slowing them down. Listen to Chapter 4, Waste, for more. 4. Create and prioritize a product backlog. This is a list at a high level of everything that needs to be built or done to make that vision a reality. This backlog exists and evolves over the lifetime of the product. It is the product roadmap. At any point, the product backlog is the single, definitive view of everything that could be done by the team ever in order of priority. Only a single product backlog exists. This means the product owner is required to make prioritization decisions across the entire spectrum. The product owner should consult with all stakeholders and the team to make sure they are representing both what people want and what can be built. Listen to Chapter 8, Priorities, for more. 5. Refine and estimate the product backlog. It is crucial that the people who are actually going to complete the items in the product backlog estimate how much effort they will take. The team should look at each backlog item and see if it is actually doable. Is there enough information to complete the item? Is it small enough to estimate? Is there a definition of done? That is, everyone agrees on what standards must be met to call something done. Does it create visible value? Each item must be able to be shown, to be demonstrated, hopefully to be potentially shippable. Do not estimate the backlog in hours, because people are absolutely terrible at that. Estimate by relative size, small, medium, or large. Or even better, use the Fibonacci sequence and estimate the point value for each item. 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, and so on. Listen to Chapter 6, Plan Reality, Not Fantasy, for more. 6. Sprint Planning. This is the first of the Scrum meetings. The team, the Scrum Master, and the product owner sit down to plan the sprint. Sprints are always a fixed length of time that is less than a month. Most people now run 1 or 2 week sprints. The team looks at the top of the backlog and forecasts how much of it they can complete in this sprint. If the team has been going for a few sprints, they should take in the number of points they did in the last sprint. That number is known as the team's velocity. The Scrum Master and the team should be trying to increase that number every sprint. This is another chance for the team and the product owner to make sure that everyone understands exactly how these items are going to fulfill the vision. Also during this meeting, everyone should agree on a sprint goal, what everyone wants to accomplish with this sprint. One of the pillars of Scrum is that once the team has committed to what they think they can finish in one sprint, that's it. It cannot be changed, it cannot be added to. The team must be able to work autonomously throughout the sprint to complete what they forecast they could. Listen to Chapter 4, Time, and Chapter 6, Plan Reality, Not Fantasy, for more. 7. Make work visible. The most common way to do this in Scrum is to create a Scrum board with 3 columns: to do, doing, done. Sticky notes represent the items to be completed, and the team moves them across the Scrum board as they are completed, one by one. Another way to make work visible is to create a burndown chart. On one axis is the number of points the team has taken into the sprint. On the other is the number of days. Every day, the Scrum Master tallies up the number of points completed and graphs them on the burndown chart. Ideally, there will be a steep downward slope leading to 0 points left on the last day of the sprint. Listen to Chapter 7, Happiness, for more. 8. Daily stand-up or daily scrum. This is the heartbeat of Scrum. Each day, at the same time, for no more than 15 minutes, the team and the Scrum Master meet and answer 3 questions. What did you do yesterday to help the team finish the sprint? What will you do today to help the team finish the sprint? Is there any obstacle blocking you or the team from achieving the sprint goal? That's it. That's the whole meeting. If it takes you more than 15 minutes, you're doing it wrong. What this does is help the whole team know exactly where everything is in the sprint. Are all the tasks going to be completed on time? Are there opportunities to help other team members overcome obstacles? There's no assigning of tasks from above. The team is autonomous. They do that. There's no detailed reporting to management. The Scrum Master is responsible for making the obstacles to the team's progress or impediments go away. Listen to Chapter 4, Time, and Chapter 6, Plan Reality, Not Fantasy, for more. 9. Sprint Review or Sprint Demo. This is the meeting where the team shows what they have accomplished during the sprint. Anyone can come, not only the product owner, the Scrum Master, and the team, but stakeholders, management, customers, whoever. This is an open meeting where the team demonstrates what they were able to move to done during the sprint. The team should only demo what meets the definition of done, what is totally and completely finished and can be delivered without any more work. It may not be a completed product, but it should be a completed feature of one. Listen to Chapter 4, Time, for more. 10. Sprint Retrospective. After the team has shown what they've accomplished during the last sprint, that thing that is done and can potentially be shipped to customers for feedback, they sit down and think about what went right, what could have gone better, and what can be made better in the next sprint. What is the improvement in the process that they, as a team, can implement right away? To be effective, this meeting requires a certain amount of emotional maturity and an atmosphere of trust. The key thing to remember is that you're not seeking someone to blame. You're looking at the process. Why did that happen that way? Why did we miss that? What could make us faster? It is crucial that people, as a team, take responsibility for their process and outcomes and seek solutions as a team. At the same time, people have to have the fortitude to bring up the issues that are really bothering them in a way that is solution-oriented rather than accusatory. And the rest of the team has to have the maturity to hear the feedback, take it in, and look for a solution rather than getting defensive. By the end of the meeting, the team and the Scrum Master should agree on one process improvement that they will implement in the next sprint. That process improvement, sometimes called the Kaizen, should be put into the next sprint's backlog with acceptance tests. That way, the team can easily see if they actually implemented the improvement and what effect it had on velocity. Listen to Chapter 7, Happiness, for more. 11. Immediately start the next sprint cycle, taking the team's experience with impediments and process improvements into account. This is J.J. Sutherland. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2014 by Jeff Sutherland and Scrum, Inc. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.